to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Lisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yes.
Kia ora from Karen, and with me today is poet, playwright, and actor Peter Bland. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. Peter is the author of 20 collections of poetry, which have been praised for their quirky obliqueness of viewpoint. It's one of my favorites from the Oxford Companion, as you might have been able to tell, from the Oxford Companion to New Zealand Literature. Their aphoristic, self-mocking wit, their splendid use of the surreal, the wry humor, the mastery of the vernacular. I actually think, Peter, that maybe even better than these descriptions would be to share a few of your titles, which rather obviate the need for descriptions, because I just love your titles. So apart from the memoir in 2004, which is called Sorry, I'm a Stranger Here Myself, the others that I really enjoy, Domestic Interiors, The Man with the Carpet Bag, The Crusoe Factor, and maybe my favorite, A Potential Poem for More Than Passing Strangers.
Thank you.
So Peter has just published the incident, which luckily brought us here today, is that Peter has just published a new book of poems for children called The Happy Garden. This is your fourth volume of poems for children, is it?
Yes.
So it's something you enjoy doing.
Absolutely, love it, yeah.
And what is it about writing for children that you enjoy?
I first started writing for children way back in the late 50s when I worked for for the school journal. And my kids liked me to read a poem to them at bedtime. This is before television, of course, and things like that. So I started writing them specifically to read to my own children. And then I realized how much I enjoyed sort of the whole performance aspect of it, you know, lifting the poem off the page. And I loved the kind of imagination that was needed for a children's poem and the kind of energy. It's a different energy for a children's poem than for a, inverted commas, grown-up poem. Yeah, different energy altogether. It comes so quickly. There's no warning. In an adult poem, there's always a lot of contemplation and a lot of leading up to it and thinking about it. And sometimes it comes, the few lines come, but in a children's poem, it just comes, bolts out the blue. You know, it's like running into the playground. I'm here.
Yeah.
No warning, it just comes, yeah.
And tied to that also the curiosity, possibly, the aspect that children are so much more curious than grown-ups, unfortunately. So there's that immediate fascination with certain aspects that you can bring out in the poem.
Yeah, absolutely. It is so physical. The physicality of a children's poem is very interesting, you know.
Yeah.
It's like it's like playtime. Yeah.
Yeah, and in that sense also, in the playful sense, it reminds me of course, of surrealism, which is, of all of the various movements, one of the more playful. And it has been noted, a lot of adjective which is used a lot for your, not only your children's poetry, but also your adult poetry.
Yeah, and I think that is because in the children's poem, there are no barriers, you know. Mermaids and unicorns can exist alongside mum and dad with no problem at all, you know. It's almost as though innately children realize that at the very core of things, everything is related to everything else.
Yeah, that's so true. That's really well said. And I thought you might read us one of the poems from the book, shall we?
Fine. This poem is called The Stone Owl. The stone owl waited on the edge of a stream. 10 million years he slept his owl dream. He waited through rain and fire and snow for the seasons to shape the owl in his soul. Then a small child came to play in the stream and reach for the stone to throw. But his feel warmed the stone owl awake, and the small child cried, "There's an owl in this stone! He's alive! He's alive!" Now the stone owl stands looking out at the moon from the high attic window of the small child's room. He has worn away eyes and a chipped away beak and heavy humped wings and sharp flinty feet. And he flies in his dreams beyond any known bird to a time long ago when stones ruled the world. He flies over oceans that have dried up and gone, over deserts where whales once played in the sun. He flies till he drops, one more stone by a lake, waiting for someone to wish him awake.
Oh, that's so, thank you so much. I just love that poem. I love the way it's got that touch of the supernatural and yet in a totally natural way. It's bringing it right out there as something that we can all enjoy and not something to be afraid of.
Thanks.
And yet there is still a real a cadence of a something very important. It's interesting. What I was noticing about the poems in the book is that the language is very rich, always very rich. I would call it a rich language. But sometimes it's rich for texture, and sometimes it's rich for the music of it. But it's never a complicated rich. It's never, which is why the poems are so accessible.
Right.
It's true in a way, instead of seeing them as children, poems for children or poems for adults, it's more about how easily accessible a poem is, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think some of the poems that I call children's poems, I write on the edge, they appeal to grown-ups as well as to children. They appeal to the child in us, you know. So the grown-ups will respond to what we call a child's poem, because it sort of hits a kind of area of imagination that they're not used to.
Yeah, or that they've stopped being used to, growing up.
Yeah, 40 or 50 years of adult struggle has kind of has killed the child in them. You have to have the child still alive in you to be able to deal with that area, I think.
It's so true, and how that instinct for a rhyme, not necessarily rhyme, that rhythmic, poetic language can stay with you on the most simple of topics. It's something reassuring and brings joy, whether or not it's something that's actually providing a new insight. It can be, I'm thinking of when my mother had Alzheimer's disease, and when she was in the later stages of her illness, we used to read Robert Louis Stevenson together, Charles Gardner Verses.
Right.
And, she would recite the poems. You could still remember it from her childhood.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
And it just brought such joy to both of us.
Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah, it just shows you how deep it goes, really.
Yeah, and Stevenson being another of those authors who had that voice, which sounds to a child like they are hearing themselves. They're not hearing someone speaking down to them.
Exactly. That's the thing. You've got to be there with standing right next to the children.
Yeah, in the memoir you talk about the early poems like Horatio holding the bridge. Didn't Horatio held the bridge?
He did hold the bridge.
Yeah, and then there was the boy who stood on the burning deck.
Yeah, and the road to Mandalay. It was all very empire materialistic stuff that we were taught in schools in the UK at that time.
And very didactic, wasn't it? It was supposed to teach you how to become a hero and
how to act heroically according
to the tenets of the British Empire.
Yeah,
or something.
Very much so.
So why don't you read us one that shows us how not to act according to the tenets of the British Empire?
This poem is called, it's from the children's book again, it's called Our Garden is a Jungle. Our garden is a jungle full of slimy beasts who try to eat Dad's butter beans and pounce on lazy bees. So look out for the elephant, a sort of giant snail, except he's got a long grey trunk and is bigger than a whale, and ignore the hippopoto slug as he tries to remember his name while always getting stuck in the mud and wondering who to blame. And beware the speedy rhinopede on 1,000 busy feet, none of which know which way to go, so always end up in a heap. Most of all, learn to fear the tiger toad, who eats anything that moves, especially stray fingers and occasionally bare toes. Never walk the lawn on naked feet and keep your eyes on the move for elephants and rhinopedes and the dreaded tiger toads.
I had a number of moments there where I had to bite my lip to stop from laughing, but I didn't want to intrude on people's pleasure in listening to this poem. I just love that voice. That is a child, if a child could have that command of vocabulary and experience, because they just can't have the years of experience, they're just younger. But that is immediately their voice, isn't it? You're speaking to them in their voice.
Yes,
Do you think that ability to take on different voices, because we'll move on in a second to your other poetry, the one that we don't know if we should call adult or grown up or general, do you think that you had a talent for that, which is what also led you into the world of playwriting and acting, or do you think that it was also your experience in, because the playwriting started fairly early, in that which then moved over into your poems and...
I think that once I started working in theatre as an actor, I quickly became aware of the relationship between the voice and poetry and how important it was to, you know, to sort of deal with the voice in poetry. And I always like reading because it lifts it off the page. It lifts the poem off the page and gives it an extra dimension. So I like the performance aspect of it.
I think a lot of people forget, I make this point a lot, so if people have listened to me other times, they might be bored by this, but how before the days of television and radio, people did gather around in the evenings, and one person played the spinet, and you'd have a song, or someone would sing, and then people would read out loud poetry stories to each other.
That's right.
And it was not considered something that people did silently. The idea of silent reading actually appeared at a certain point in human history and was a surprise to many people.
Right. And I still remember very fondly, you know, my kids gathering around to listen to a poem, to listen to a new poem. It was always an event. And it had an amazing effect, I realized, on my grown-up, inverted commas, work. Because writing children's poetry opened up the imagination for me, and then I started to see my children's drawings and their play games and their world, their imaginative world. And this was at a time when New Zealand in the 50s was very repressive and very sort of subdued and... very grey. And so it came as a real insight for me to see my children's imaginations brought me alive, and I was able to use something of their view of the world in my, inverted commas, grown-up poetry. It gave it an extra dimension, which at that time I was writing very angry social realist poems about the sort of terrible repression of New Zealand life at that time. And through my children, I was able to expand into a different kind of poetry. Mm-hmm. It's really down to them that I was able to sort of pick that up and use it.
Yeah, the sort of why should children have all the fun?
Yeah.
And you're not going to bring it into your grown-up poems in exactly the same way, but it's still the same sense of taking a risk.
Yeah, it comes from the same place, too.
So let's move on to that. So I've got two books here, which I think are your two most recent books of poetry, which are A Fugitive Presence and Voodoo. I lose Voodoo. Somewhere I had it. So that's from 2016, 2018. And I would like to shamelessly ask you to start us off here in our move to the adult poems by reading a particular poem rather than letting you choose, because it's one which particularly spoke to me, and I think it will speak to many, and it's called Harbors.
Yeah, it's a sort of prose poem.
Yes.
Harbors. Whenever we dream of harbors, they're waiting for us to arrive. And the anticipation of sailing into them is timeless and intense. Harbors are a promise waiting to be fulfilled. My first harbor was long ago. I was born in one. It was crammed with old trawlers and barrels of fish, with whistles blowing, funnels belching black smoke, and girls with sharp knives in salty dresses and clogs. There was always a sludge of ice and oil underfoot, gulls shrieking, nets being hauled in, damp, smelly stalls selling crabs, winkles and shrimps. When I left that harbour, it must have sailed away, because when I returned years later, it was empty, drab, a mere ghost of its former self. Since then, I've seen many harbours come and go. I've seen Pacific harbours full of mangroves and hollowed-out canoes, Mediterranean harbours lying like sleeping cats in the sun, lonely northern harbours marooned in half-frozen fjords, There are Henry Miller Harbours, Conrad Harbours, D.H. Lawrence Harbours, Memento Mori, and Homeric Harbours with sunsets the colour of blood. Everyone has a small harbour moored in their hearts, perhaps one with a run-down cafe and a few forgotten boats bobbing close to shore. The sort of harbour you can only put together for yourself, where day after day you can sit and wonder how it got there, knowing you'll never want to leave.
That is so lovely. The description of the harbors, it reminds me somewhat of another favorite poem of mine, and I know he's a friend of yours, Bob Orr's poem about rivers.
Oh,
you know, yeah. Rivers, harbors, or something. I think that this is we are in New Zealand. I think this also speaks to everyone.
Bob's great at that.
Well, you are great. So I'll shout out to Bob. But I think there's something in particular about I've been fascinated by harbors my whole life. I grew up in near San Diego, another great harbor of the world. But it's that point of stepping off. It's you're at the edge. It's just one step, and that will take you onto one of these ships that will take you out to anywhere in the world.
Right.
It's you're always living right there. It's unlike the people in a place far from the ocean that watch the trains go by and have to wish one day they might get on one of those trains.
Yeah.
But you've got it right there, one step away. So my first harbor, so I know this because I read your wonderful memoir, but for those who don't, so that would be Scarborough, where you were born.
Yes. And North Yorkshire.
Just it'd be wonderful to just have a few minutes so you can tell us about how you got from there in North Yorkshire to here.
I remember I was born in Scarborough and spent the first 5 or 6 years of my life there. So I remember it in pre-war years, really, as a really working harbour, you know, with fishing boats and herring gulls, and that's how I remember it now. It's not like that at all. It's sort of a very touristy sort of little harbour. During the war, I was moved around a lot because of the bombing. So, and my mother worked in a munitions factory. She was told to work in a munitions factory in the Midlands. So we moved away from Scarborough when I was about 9 to a munitions factory in the English Midlands where I grew up. But I lost my parents and my family during the war or just after the war. So I was orphaned by the time I was 15 or 14, I think.
And you had already left school and started to work.
Yeah, I left school and started. I was working in a local boot factory. Yeah, and it's funny, you know. It had never occurred to me that I could be an actor or a poet or anything like that. I didn't see it. It didn't seem possible at that time. I mean, your view of things is limited, especially if you've got no family to back you up or people to take an interest in you. Mm.
And certainly it was tied, in a few hundred years before that, any creative activity was tied to having the patron who would support you, and then in more modern times, the education, which would get you into where there were jobs and grants that should allow you the time to write. But certainly a 14-year-old boy working in a boot factory would not have seen that, and with no family support.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's amazing, really, that I managed to get here eventually. Pure accident. I was taken in by the local vicar who looked after me until I did my 2 years national service in the army. When I came out of the army, I opened the newspaper and saw you can come to Canada or you can come to Australia or you can come to New Zealand for £10 as an emigrant. And I thought, yeah, I need a completely new start. I need to get away and make a completely new start somewhere. And I chose New Zealand because it was an island. Like England, like the UK, and I thought, oh, that sounds really great. There'll be palm trees and hula girls, and it'll be magnificent.
The sun will always be shining.
Yeah, that's right. I can't wait to get and be part of that sort of South Pacific, sexy, colourful world. Didn't turn out like that in 53.
So they put you on a ship.
They did.
And it took like a 6 week trip or something.
Yeah, 6 week trip. Yeah.
And
1500. I was crammed on a tiny little ship of about 11,000 tons. dance.
And you said the men on one side, and in the memoir it says the women, men on one side.
Yeah. We were kept apart as much as possible. Yeah. Breeding wasn't to start until we arrived in the colonies, and then with the locals, of course.
Yeah. So you were being saved up for the locals.
Yeah, that's right. We were all being saved up.
Yeah, you were being brought in for that purpose.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you did talk about how the closer you got to land, the more there was sort of a sexual charge in the air, almost as if the New Zealand was the lover waiting for you.
That's right. Yeah. Everybody felt it, I think.
And then you sailed into Wellington Harbour, speaking of harbours, and you saw, how is it described? It's in the book, it's the elemental loneliness of the place that you could, first you're coming along the land, getting close to Wellington and wondering where are all the towns?
Yeah, where are all the people?
Where are all the people? Yeah. And then the boat turns, what does a boat do? Jives or whatever it does.
Comes into Wellington Harbour. And suddenly there it is.
Houses clinging to the hillside.
Yeah.
And a very damp sort of look to the whole thing. There's a wonderful line. You say, lives were huddled together in their circle of damp hills. Man's presence was tissue thin. A whole new psychology was going to be needed to cope with this landscape before we could resume to call it home.
Yeah. And it was.
It's interesting. I have written here, before we could resume to call it home, but perhaps it was presume. But it's kind of, it could be both, because you had a home before. Now you need to resume having a home, but it's going to be this new home.
That's right. Yeah.
So it did, it was quite a culture shock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tremendous. I don't know why. I've never been able to realize, account for the fact that why New Zealand was so repressive and so suppressed just for those few years in the 50s. I mean, you can read, all the writers noticed it, you know. Frank Sargeson talked about it. Where is the camaraderie gone that we had in the sort of 30s? And I can remember one of the painters saying, all my painter friends are either drunk or they're being taken away in a little green van. It was Owls Do Cry time, you know. There was a lot of breakdowns and a lot of lost souls, really.
Yeah,
we were all supposed to live in a state house and breed. Yeah. That was a basic thing, you know.
Yeah. Or a little a place in the country, the quarter acre in the country with the white picket fence around it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the French poet Blaise Cendrars, did you know he came to New Zealand? He was shipped out on, he was a merchant in the Merchant Marines. And he came to New Zealand and he wrote about what was so strange to him as a Frenchman was that the people living in the country who should have been earthy, as the French peasant type character, were instead middle class, clung to their middle classness in their little house with the picket fence around it, guarding their perfect middle classness.
Right.
And I had, actually, I don't know if classness is a noun, but anyway, their middle classness. I had read a lot about how one of these, what you're saying, you know, why was New Zealand so repressed was this fact that as compared to Australia, for instance, the people that immigrated to New Zealand were lower middle class, were people who had reached the middle class in England but had a tenuous hold on it and thought that they could get a stronger hold on it in New Zealand. And so therefore that reinforced, and one of the worst things we know about middle classness is the looking at what your neighbors are doing, worrying about your reputation.
And it's conformity.
And conformity, exactly. That's exactly the word, yeah.
And the conformity was pretty dense, you know. I mean, the shops closed early. The whole country closed down at the weekends. You couldn't get the pubs. 6 o'clock closing kept going on until about 67 or 68, I think. Things did start to change in the middle to late 60s. And I think largely because you're starting to get a new generation that had travelled more, you know, knew about life in other places and brought that back to New Zealand. And I think that's something that in literature isn't taken into account enough. The immigrant imagination is a constant thing that comes in all the time. It drifts in and helps to augment what's already there.
Yeah, so you, as one of the immigrants, you were saying, I didn't dream I could write poetry, but you actually, in the book, you talk about having thrown some of your poetry overboard when you arrived. So you had been writing.
I tried, you know. Yeah, I was writing sing-song stuff, you know. The devil's on a donkey, can't you hear him ride? Listen to the wind and the moaning of the tide. All that sort of crap.
Yeah, but it's that apprenticeship. What you were doing is too closely copying what you had been taught in school.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and so I threw all that overboard along with my ration book. Because we were still rationed in the UK until 1954. So, that's 10 years after the war ended, nearly.
Yeah.
I mean, absurd. Absolutely absurd.
It's such a wonderful metaphor, this throwing overboard poems in a ration book and arriving in a new land. Where you proceeded to shock people. What was the story about the nose? That had a four-letter word and you were not able to get a grant.
That's right. Yeah. I read a poem called The Nose, And I think it's the first time that the four-letter word had been used. And they wouldn't print it, so I had to change it to something else. Otherwise, the book, which was an anthology, everybody else would have lost their chance to have a poem in the anthology. So, but later on, I put the word back in again because it was pure reportage. I was simply reporting what somebody had said to me in the street, you know. Yeah.
So even if it hadn't been, it would be a point for being allowed to.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So you stayed in Wellington for many years and were a part of a very important poetry scene, which was already had taken a different stance than an older poetic.
And people like Jim Baxter, Louis Johnson, and myself, we sort of tried to turn poetry. We tried to get poetry to come to grips with the sort of modern urban life, you know, suburban life. And prior to that, it had all been myths of origin and historical stuff. Well, a lot of it had. But we wanted to sort of get to grips with life as it was from day to day, you know, in families and children. I mean, I think Fleur Adcock and myself were the first people to write a poem about children, and a grown-up poem about children and about family life. Wasn't done before that.
Yeah, it was considered too plebeian a topic something.
That's
right. So, and again, back comes the story of the voice and the vernacular and speaking in a language which people actually use in day-to-day life.
And I love the vernacular in New Zealand. I just loved it. There was no class, no echoes of empire. There was a kind of dry sort of matter-of-factness about it. It was a little bit grim, actually, and put you in your place. But it was full of all sorts of possibilities, you know, which were quite thrilling. It was very democratic.
Yeah, that's a really good reminds me of something that I did want to say, which is I've been hearing about your Facebook channel now, where Peter reads poetry. Tell us about that.
My daughter, I'm useless on anything to do with computers and Facebooks, but my daughter said to me, I really like it, Dad, when I overhear you reading poems to yourself, and I think you should put these poems up on Facebook, and I'll do it for you, and she did. So I started reading poems on Facebook, which I really love doing because it's so intimate, and it's like speaking to one person, and it's had a nice response. I get a feedback, which is very, 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 very nice, you know. I mean, it's a lonely life, but being a poet, so to get some kind of some feedback is great, you know. And that the one particular from Anita Arloff, really, I love that one. She said, yes, we like it because we feel we're inside the poem with you.
Yeah, that's
you know, and I thought, yeah, God, I'm so pleased you feel like that because it's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, because you have that ability. You're looking at the person sitting in front of you who've tuned in now because they say, oh, I'd like to hear Peter read a poem to me, as I would right now, and I think our listeners too.
Okay, here it is. Living close to the border. For years, we've put off getting here. In the end, there was nowhere else to go. Rumours from across the border suggest we were always passing through. But the light is lovelier than it's ever been. Trees and flowers glow from within. Ponds reflect old childhood memories. Wolves and tigers lick our hands. Why does it take a lifetime to get here? Where are we going? How long can we stay? Were we always in exile this side of the border? Why do we live on the verge of tears, yet laugh out loud so late in the day?
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day.